quite often we might write an energy momentum tensor as a perfect fluid. So you'll have seen something, and we did this with Tolman, Oppenheimer, Volkoff, where you have a T naught naught that's the energy density and then a homogeneous pressure field, which is the spatial components of T. But of course, a lot of the physics that we do involves field theory. So we want to think about how gravity interacts with fields. Now, you saw that in the tutorial last week, looking at the Riesner-Nordström solution, where you looked at a black hole with an electric, I guess it was electric rather than the magnetic charges, but with an electric field, some electrically charged black hole. So you've already seen this notion of solving Einstein's equations when they're not in vacuum. But what we'd like to do is to put Einstein gravity on the same footing as field theory. In other words, we want to think about a Lagrangian or action principle for Einstein gravity. So this is going to be the topic of this lecture. And hopefully there'll be enough time to discuss going beyond Einstein-Hilbert. Usually, I guess we tend to say Einstein action rather than Einstein-Hilbert. But anyway, so what we'd like to do is we'd like to get a Lagrangian, which we can say when we vary it will give us the left-hand side of Einstein equations, the Einstein tensor. So that means we're looking for some sort of scalar field. But the other thing that we have to tackle is integrating on our manifold. So there's two sort of steps to this. So the first thing I'll look at is integration on the manifold. So typically, if we have a Lagrangian density, we would, in flat space, we would take the integral d4x. We would just say, take a sort of standard volume element and integrate over some little box of length, you know, with sides dx, dy, dz, dt. Now, it's obvious that we're not just going to be able to take this expression and lift it up to the manifold, because immediately we can see if I do a coordinate transformation, then I get a factor of the Jacobian. But we already saw something like this when I was talking about the epsilon tensor, that if we just took the alternating symbol, that wasn't really a tensor, but more of a tensor density. Whereas if we multiplied it by the square root of g, we got something that transformed like a tensor. And if we think about that in the context of what I'm trying to write here, what I'm trying to, in flat space, this is a volume element. So if we focus on that word volume, on our manifold, if we have a metric, we know that the volume should somehow have some information of the underlying metric in it, because the metric is what tells us about distance on the manifold. And so it's a bit silly to try and do a volume element with no information of the metric whatsoever. So we kind of know how to fix it. If I take root g d4x, then I know that under a coordinate transformation, root g gets a factor of dx dy. And so I get the same expression, but written in terms of the y coordinates. So this is how, if we want to write things as an integral with a volume element, that's how we have to do it. We have to write down a covariant volume element, which means we have to have the right sort of information about the metric. So we have to put a square root of g. So you could also see this, perhaps, as saying, well, this is really sort of dt cross dx cross, you know, dy cross dz, because in the fourth form, you have this square root of g kind of implicit within the expression. So although I'm going to be keeping with the equivalent of what we're kind of used to with volume elements, but with the right measure, the root g in there, you will probably also see when people write down actions or Lagrangians, you might also see it written down in form language. So I'm just highlighting that at this point. So let's look at what happens to our square root of g. So we're thinking about developing an action principle, and when we have a Lagrangian and an action, we find our equations of motion by variation with respect to the physical fields. Now, in general relativity, our physical observable is distance, so our field, in some sense, is the metric, so we're going to vary our action with respect to the metric. So we need to know how to vary the determinant of the metric. So we use an identity for the determinant, which is that a determinant is the exponential of the trace of the log of the matrix. So if I take delta of a determinant, then I get delta of trace log m, times the exponential of trace log m, which is just det m, so it tells me that the variation of my determinant is going to be trace of m inverse delta m times det m. So in our case, when we want to take delta of root minus g, well, that just gives us 1 over root minus g, and then it's delta of minus g, so I get minus g g inverse delta g. So that's how I vary my metric. And so overall, I get a half root minus g g inverse delta g, or if I prefer, and I will be preferring, to vary things with respect to the inverse metric, then I pull in a minus sign. So this is going to allow us to vary our action with respect to the metric, but part of that variational process is the fact that the measure that we have, the volume element, also depends on our physical field, the metric. So this is, that's one of the pieces of information or the puzzle that we need to know. So if I want to have a look at an application of this, if I take a derivative of root g, so what I've written up there on the top board is what we're going to need as part of our input to calculating the variation of the action. But this is just something else, another consequence of that identity, that you see a derivative of root g gives you a particular trace of the connection components. Why did I write that down? Because when I vary my action, if there's this root g in the volume element, I'm going to, when I integrate by parts, I'm going to keep picking up factors of the derivative root g. So again, this is another piece of information that I need. So let's just look at what happens with a massless scalar field. Which has a very simple Lagrangian. It's just the kinetic term, a half grad phi squared. So our action, S phi, would be the integral over our volume element of the scalar Lagrangian, a half d phi squared. So let me just be absolutely explicit here. That, of course, grad phi squared has a piece of the metric in it. So now I'm going to say, okay, let's vary this action. Okay, so I vary it with respect to phi. And I get a factor of 2, d phi d delta phi. So I've cancelled off the half. I've then also got plus a half dA phi dB phi delta g inverse. So now you're beginning to see why I might have put that expression there with respect to delta g inverse. And then finally, I've also got to vary the square root of g, and when I vary the square root of g, I've written that down there, I get the square root of g, times a factor of the metric. So that's what I get when I take delta of the action, oh, missing a delta GAB there, aren't I? So I would say that the variation of the action here should be so I've simply written down what I mean by my variation of the action with respect to its constituent fields. And so each of these are the functional derivative of S with respect to the individual fields. So I can read off, having said which, I was about to say I can read off, but I can't quite read off because I've got a derivative in here. So I have to integrate by parts. So when I do that, so having integrated by parts here, my delta phi is being acted on by the partial derivative with respect to xb. And so I have to take that b partial derivative of everything that remains, which is a root g d phi inverse g. So that's what I've written down there. But I can see that that is just minus db of grad b phi, and then it's minus 1 over root g db root g grad phi. But now you see why I wrote down this identity over here. The partial derivative of the square root of g is just the square root of g times this trace with the gammas. And so that's simply the D'Alembertian acting on phi. So what I've done here in a general curved space is derived the simple wave equation. So a massless scalar field you expect to satisfy the free wave equation. So here it does. But where now the wave operator is the curved space wave operator rather than just the flat space wave operator. So that is our scalar equation of motion, and it's what we expect. It's giving us the right answer. Now, if I peel off the other piece, the variation of the scalar field action with respect to the metric, then I see that this looks like the energy momentum tensor of the free scalar field. And again, this is making complete sense because if we imagine that we can construct a gravitational action such that when I vary with respect to my gravitational field, the metric G, I get the Einstein tensor, then if I'm varying my matter Lagrangian with respect to G, I would hope to get the energy momentum tensor, the other side of Einstein's equations. So this looks promising. It's telling us that we vary the action with respect to the metric, some matter field, we get something that looks like an energy momentum tensor. So now we need to start looking at the gravity side of things. So the obvious thing to try, given that we want to have a scalar, is the Ricci scalar. Normally, when you do construct field theory Lagrangians, and you look for a Lagrangian, you're looking for a kinetic piece minus a potential piece. So normally, your kinetic piece would just involve first derivatives of your field, like the scalar field action there, half grad phi squared. The problem we found when we're looking at geometry and geometrical invariance is there's nothing really involving first derivatives of the scalar field that's a geometric invariant. Yep?
So I have a question with respect to the energy momentum test.
Mm-hmm.
So in the usual field theory in flat space, the energy momentum test is just a conserved current.
You don't derive it this way, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are those, I mean, both pictures equivalent in this case?
Almost exactly equivalent. I think the only technical difference is the way this is constructed, because our metric is symmetric, our energy momentum tensor will always be symmetric. From a gravitational perspective, we need that because obviously our Ricci tensor is symmetric. But I think it's possible to have an energy momentum tensor when you construct it from a field theory perspective that might not be symmetric. So I think there is a notional difference, perhaps.
The fact of being symmetric or not doesn't worry me. I mean, you can only make the energy momentum tensor. But in this case, when I have a metric that depends on the coordinates, I don't have energy. Translation invariant necessarily, right?
Yeah.
So in the case of usual field theory, you obtain the energy momentum tensor by making a variation of the action with respect to this translation variation, right? But in this case, we didn't. So I'm worried about...
So how would you construct it in via some generalization of the other method, you mean?
Right, yeah. I mean, like, try to connect both ideas.
Uh-huh. I'll give you my off-the-cuff answer, but I might not want to be held to account for it. So typically, when you want to translate things from a sort of old flat space type of intuition or language, and you want to put them into the curved manifold, typically what you do is you then use the fact that you've got these local coordinate charts. So you might use the fact that you've got a local Lorentz invariance to try and start piecing together, you know, the old flat space construction in the context of the new manifold. Now, sometimes that's good enough and that works straight away as it is. Other times it doesn't quite work because of the fact that you're in this more general curved space. So that sort of approach might well work for the scalar field. You could imagine for things like electromagnetism where you've got vector fields, that you would start, what you might get is a sort of non-covariant expression, which just involves the sort of background, some partial derivatives. So it might give you, it might not always work, but it might be that the amount by which it doesn't work is kind of obvious, and so you know how to generalize it. So I would always say, if you know how to do something in flat space, to see how to do it in curved space, you use local Lorentz invariance or this local coordinate chart and just kind of try and build on that. So that's my off-the-cuff answer. I'm not sure whether that'll, without sort of sitting and thinking about it, whether that would go through. So I must admit, if I'm calculating an energy momentum tensor, I absolutely always do it this way, because I guess I'm always interested typically in what the effects of the energy momentum tensor are. So, you know, so I'll put my hands up and say, this is how I always do it. So I'm trying to remember where I was in that sort of stream of consciousness about kinetic terms in the action. So our obvious candidate is the Ricci scalar, which is a little unusual as a kinetic term because it doesn't involve first order derivatives of G. It actually involves second order derivatives of G. So we will be seeing that this has a technical consequence, and not just, I suppose, ultimately, I'm going to move beyond just the technicality, but for today, it'll just be something to note. In that, typically, again, when we do, which I glossed over a little bit when I was doing it for the scalar field, when we do a variational principle, we always end up integrating by parts. And the argument about why that's okay is that we are taking, in this case with our manifold, we're imagining we're interested in a region, and any variation, so we look for things which are locally stationary, so we're looking for little variations of delta phi or delta g, which vanish as we go to the edge of our system, or if we have a system with a boundary, they vanish on the boundary. So just hold that thought in mind for when we're dealing with something which has a second derivative. Because if you have a second derivative, integrate by parts, you get a first derivative. And that's different from saying delta of q or whatever vanishes. OK, so what we need is we need the variation of the Ricci scalar. And fingers crossed, it's going to be what we need to give us the Einstein tensor. So our Ricci scalar is the trace of the Ricci tensor. And so when I vary it, I'm going to get two pieces. The second piece, that looks nice, because that's the first bit of the Einstein tensor. I've also got the root g floating at the beginning, you know, in the integral, which is going to give me minus a half r gab. So this is great, because that, together with the variation of the measure, is going to give me my Einstein tensor. So what happens to this piece? Because if I get any contribution from that, that's going to change the structure of my Einstein equations. So I'll write down what it is, and then I'll show why it is that. So the variation of RAB is given in terms of covariant derivatives of the discrepancy in the connection, which you get when you go from GAB to GAB plus delta G. So the difference of two connections is a tensor, And so what I've written down with covariant derivatives is a tensor. So there's a simple proof using a technique called normal coordinates. Now, did you do normal coordinates in the first course of general relativity? Okay. So the idea of normal coordinates is it's locally a flat frame. I'm putting locally in inverted commas because really, strictly speaking, what you've done is you've made a coordinate transformation at a point in the neighborhood of a point P such that the connection vanishes completely at P. So you can always do that because under a coordinate transformation, your connection transforms, first of all, the covariant piece plus that correction, which is the second derivative of the coordinate transformation. So you simply cook up that second derivative. You make a specific coordinate transformation which precisely cancels the gamma at a point P, and then you know your gamma is very nearly zero in a neighborhood of P. And so the notion of normal coordinates is to say that, so gamma equals zero, but d gamma, or a derivative of gamma, is non-zero. So in normal coordinates, you would have, if you were trying to look at the Riemann tensor, you wouldn't keep the pieces involving gamma-gamma, you'd only have the pieces which involved, the first pieces which involved the derivative of gamma. And then you kind of manipulate your expression using this simplification of ignoring gamma, you end up with something which is partial derivatives, because partial derivatives are the same as covariant derivative in these special coordinates. And then you say, I'll sort of try and say it in words, it'll probably not sound like it makes sense till you see it in action. And then you say, well, I need, in normal coordinates, partial is covariant, so I write my expression with covariant derivatives, and then I say that that's now a geometrically invariant expression. If it's true in one coordinate system, it's true in them all. So you can see this here with this Palatini lemma. You can see that this looks like the beginning of the Riemann tensor, and it would in fact be if you just had partial derivatives there. So you can see in normal coordinates, this would look like partial derivative of each of these delta gammas. So let me have a look at one of the expressions that I might need. I want the partial derivative of the difference in my connection. Don't seem to be having much luck with the chalk today. I think I need to put another line in here. Put a very sketchy. So if I want to look at the variation in my connection, then if I look at my delta gamma CAB, I've got a delta G inverse, but when I take my partial derivative of that in normal coordinates, it's just a first derivative of the metric. And I've chosen specifically my coordinates such that first derivatives, which are the things that make up the connection, vanish. So I only really need this combination sitting inside here. And so I get a half GCD So I get these combinations of second derivatives of my metric. Now I'd like that instead to be in terms of the inverse metric. I'm running C, grab B, so I need. Right. I'm having index confusion this morning. So, what I want to do is I want to swap this variation of my metric for a variation of the inverse metric. So I've got one free index here, A. So that's why I've got this, I've raised that up to an E. And here I've got one derivative, which is the B derivative. And then this one is simply contracted with one of the with the internal index on the G. Then I have to invert my A and B. Okay, so this is all in normal coordinates, okay? So first of all, I just wrote down the partial derivative expression. Then, because I know that in normal coordinates, partial derivatives are the same as covariant derivatives, I've written things down in terms of covariant derivatives. And so here, if I write down what my variation of the Ricci tensor is, then in normal coordinates, the variation of the Ricci tensor, the Ricci tensor is just given in terms of the derivatives of gamma. So the variation of the Ricci tensor is given in terms of derivatives of gamma. And so I can write that down explicitly. Here I've actually computed what the variation of the connection is. So that's the first term. So when I trace on A and B, I get on this first line gives me minus second covariant derivative of the inverse metric and gives me a factor of a half box of delta G inverse. And then the second term, if I trace here on the connection, I end up just getting this box delta G inverse. So my variation of delta RAB, when I contract here, this looks like a total derivative. So I can look now at the variation of my proposed action for gravity, root gr, and I can say, what does it give me? Well, I get the RAB delta GAB term, which I identified as being something I was pleased with earlier. I get minus a half R GAB coming from the variation of root G. And then I've got this overall term from there, which is minus these derivatives of the metric. Now, I can write this piece as 1 over root g dA, root g. So that's the total derivative there. And this piece so that's what I meant. Both of them are a total derivative. As far as variation of the action is concerned. So what I've got here is a constant times the Einstein tensor times delta inverse metric plus an integration over a boundary when I integrate by parts these two terms. So I'm just writing this boundary term down explicitly to emphasize the fact when you do a variational principle, you integrate by parts, your normal argument would be that delta G vanished on the boundary, or delta phi, and you just forget about the boundary term. Here, what we're really saying is, in order for this to work properly, we should have the fact that this is a variation of normal derivatives. So we need to impose a little bit more than we usually do in terms of applying this variational principle. So NA is the normal. So it's a normal integration by parts. If you have a volume integral, which is a total derivative, it gives you the integral of the thing inside the total derivative on the boundary, contracted with the normal to the boundary. So it's a standard Gauss law. I'm saying delta M, it could be some region within delta M. It's just a boundary, the boundary of the region in which you're looking at your equations of motion. So given that when I varied the scalar action with respect to the inverse metric, I got a half TAB, and I know that my Einstein equations are GAB is 8 pi G TAB. This tells me that C is minus 1 over 16 pi G, i.e. my gravitational action, my Einstein-Hilbert action, has a factor of 1 over 16 pi G. So for now, I've probably gone into more detail about this boundary term than normally you would do when first meeting the Einstein-Hilbert action. But that's because I want to come back to it. For now, we ignore this. Boundary wrinkle, so to speak. It doesn't quite work as per usual variational principle, but it's doing the right sort of thing. The worst thing that happens is we get a boundary term. We can always come back to that and think about boundaries in a bit. So we now have a gravitational action. So we now know how to incorporate our gravity into field theory. And we'll be looking, I think, at that at some point later in the week. Yep.
One thing about the boundary term. So the Einstein equations just give you the metric, but says nothing about the actual manifold, right? About the topology of the manifold.
Right. So usually you figure that out by once you've got your solution, you then start to analyze it.
So,
yeah.
So in the case where I construct this variational principle for the same Einstein equations. I can have different manifolds with the same metric, so what about the boundary term? I mean, the boundary term might change whether I change from one manifold to another one, but
I suppose so. When you ask a question like that, I always stop and try and think, can I think of an example, you know? And I can't so much think of an example. I mean, what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back to that boundary term and build up a description of submanifolds in, you know, using a Gauss-Kadatze formalism so that we can actually analyze the boundary and include the boundary physically. So a lot of the time, if you're doing sort of physics type of gravity, the boundary, it's not really so much relevant to think about boundaries to the manifold because we don't usually imagine sort of going out there and hitting a boundary in our universe. But, however, There are a variety of reasons why we might want to actually not be quite so lazy and come back and think about boundaries. It could be because we actually want to have a physical boundary in the space-time. We find that we can actually have a dynamical boundary. We can give it, you know, we can actually make it something physical. So that might be where we had a membrane or a domain wall in our four-dimensional space-time. So that's one example. The other example where I want to make use of the boundary is if you want to look at gravitational actions, or in particular, if you want to sort of play a game of pseudo-quantum gravity looking at Euclidean actions, then you need to know about the boundary, because in computing the actual value of the action, rather than just looking at sort of local dynamical equations of motion, the boundary will contribute to the action in principle and quite often in practice. So that's the other reason I want to come back to it. So in terms of, for example, when I was saying that you, when you construct a Lagrangian, you've got kinetic and potential terms, then whereas here, this Ricci term is second derivative, so it's not normal kinetic type of term, then if you think about evaluating an action for solutions, you would think that physically distinct solutions should have different actions. So flat space, somehow you'd imagine, would be some sort of minimum, or at least, you know, a special point. Whereas we have an awful lot of solutions which are Ricci flat, for example, the Schwarzschild solution. So a black hole satisfies R equals zero. So if we just had R as our gravitational action, just R, then that's a little bit worrying, because then there'd be a whole class of solutions that all had exactly the same action vis-a-vis zero. So in fact, when we come back to this boundary term and start not being so lazy and start taking it seriously, we'll see that in fact it's, you know, it's really quite important, because it will contribute to the act, to the overall value of the action, though obviously not to local bulk, you know, sort of within the volume of space, space-time, not local dynamics. So it's one of those things that, you know, that eventually you kind of sort of, once you've got the whole picture, it all makes sense. But normally people don't make such a song and dance about it when they first introduce the Einstein-Hilbert action, but it's simply because I'm going to be coming back to that later in the week, I hope. So I just wanted to finish off by talking about going beyond the Einstein-Hilbert action. And just thinking about an example in which, in fact, this second line, you know, this other part, delta RAB, the fact that you've got those second derivatives of G, where that is important. So this phi R, here I've, this is like replacing 1 over 16 pi g. It's one way of thinking about it. It's saying now that you, your Newton's constant is not constant, it's a scalar field. So this is known as Brands-Dickey gravity, or sometimes Jordan-Brands-Dickey gravity. And it was introduced as a means of trying to satisfy or to tackle Mach's principle in Einstein gravity, which is somehow this notion of how do you know what your inertial frame is if you're rotating? How do you know you're rotating in an empty universe? So in our universe, you could say, well, the universe itself defines a sort of fixed frame, so you're rotating with reference to the distant stars. And so there's this notion that gravitation kind of defines itself, I guess. And so there's this idea that the gravitational interaction, or the strength of the gravitational interaction, is somehow dependent on the matter in the universe. Now, this approach doesn't quite work. However, the notion of having this scalar in front of the Einstein action has a more general range of applicability in terms of scalar tensor theories of gravity. So I'm just going to stick to this very basic format, but there are a lot of different types of extension of Einstein gravity. So if we look here at what our equations of motion are, let's fix in on this term that would give us nothing if we had pure Einstein gravity. So now when I integrate by parts, I do get contributions to my equations of motion because I'm picking up derivatives of phi. Okay? So I when I integrate by parts, each time one of those derivatives transfers itself onto the phi field. So as well as something that looks like my Einstein tensor, I'm picking up derivatives of my phi field. So the left-hand side of Einstein equations becomes not just the Einstein tensor, but additional pieces which depend on derivatives of the phi field. So our full Brown-Sticky action includes a kinetic piece for the phi field, and I end up with equations of motion So this is varying with respect to GAB, and that's varying with respect to phi. And then I can combine to get a pure equation of motion for phi. Which couples or depends on the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So this was the reason why Brands and Dickey hoped that this might satisfy Mach's principle, the notion that you have a Newton's constant that reacts to the total amount of matter present. It doesn't quite work, but again, if you have a good idea, it kind of never quite dies. You know, it always comes back in some guise or another. And scalar fields in the context of gravity just crop up all the time. So, for example, in any string theories or string gravity derived from string theory, you have the dilaton, which is a sort of e to the 2 phi type coupling. So you get a scalar field. You also get it when you have, get scalar fields when you have extra dimensions. So although you have to be rather cautious with scalar tensor gravity, it's something that does actually crop up once you try and go beyond Einstein gravity. So it is something that you need to think about. And I just want to note that in this case, in this particular expression, matter couples minimally to G. So in other words, you have d phi squared equaling GAB dA phi dB phi. But the gravitational action is not simply, I mean, by construction, it's obviously not Einstein-Hilbert. And so gravitational equations are more complicated. Many people don't like to have the gravitational side of things being complicated, and so they change frame to make the gravitational action like Einstein equations, but then matter is non-minimally coupled. So what I mean by that in words, those words, is that what you do is you rescale your metric to cancel out that scalar function. And you do this via a conformal transformation. So you say that you have two different expressions of your metric. So omega here you could imagine doing a global rescaling of your metric by simply halving the size of your rulers and changing the definition of a second, so that 1 second became 2 seconds. So that would be a global rescaling of your coordinates. That would just be t goes to lambda t, x goes to lambda x, and so on. But what you can also do is do a local rescaling of coordinates, and you're not changing angles, you're just changing lengths. And this is what we understand to be a conformal transformation, something that doesn't change angles, but just scales lengths locally. Then our new connection is going to be our old connection. Plus derivatives of omega. And then I leave it as a nice exercise to the reader. So obviously, if you were sitting here in four-dimensional space-time, you could see that your R hat would then be omega to the minus 2R plus extra pieces. The square root of G hat would be omega to the 4. Square root of g, therefore r hat root g hat would be omega squared r root g. So if you chose your omega factor to cancel off the phi factor, what you get is the Einstein action for gravity, but you have then modified the way your matter couples to gravity, and you've also modified the kinetic terms of your scalar field. So this is a trick. We'll kind of come back to it. I just wanted to introduce it here. And this would be the Einstein frame. So what we've seen here is not only we've derived the standard gravitational action, the Einstein-Hilbert action, r root g. We've shown how it gives us the Einstein equations. I've tried to discuss, it's a little bit of a spoiler for future lectures, I've discussed the boundary terms, and then I've simply made a commentary about scalar tensor theories, which are just ways of going beyond Einstein gravity. So one of the things that we're quite interested in currently is whether we really live in a universe with Einstein gravity. Because the larger the scales we look at in our own universe, we have to introduce more and more unknowns. So we start off looking at the galactic scale, we have to add dark matter. We go to the cosmological scale, we've got to add dark energy. And we end up in this rather bizarre circumstance where our universe is about 95% of stuff we don't know. And so we could just stick with these sort of things that we don't know, dark matter, dark energy, but a popular alternative is to sort of say, well, maybe it's not Einstein gravity. So I think any course in gravity has to raise that possibility. And the simplest way of going beyond Einstein gravity is to add scalars. So you'll be seeing other ways of going beyond Einstein gravity, but this is the most conceptually simple.